Blog Talk Radio.
This is the RF Radio Show with OJ and Dreadfish.
Hello and good evening. It's 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and you're listening to Radio RF. I'm Dreadfish, here with Itty OJ. Today, we'll be interviewing our forum member, Mazdayan, about Zoroastrianism.
I'm actually pretty excited for tonight's episode. I don't know a lot about this particular region, so it's going to be a good opportunity for me to learn, and I hope a lot of our listeners tonight feel the same way. And I've been told we might have some special listeners in today, so hello to Professor Star's class, and thank you for tuning in, and I hope you find today's episode as educational as I do.
Yeah, I'm also interested to hear about Zoroastrianism. I remember studying it in, you know, the world religions class in community college that so many people take, and I've studied it a little bit on my own time, too. But I don't remember too much about it, so I'm interested to learn more about it.
What else have you been learning in school recently?
Well, as we have mentioned pretty much most of the shows in the past, I've been going to school for computer stuff. And recently, I've moved on to the security half of my network and security class. And I thought this might be a good topic to talk about. So I guess I'll go ahead and start now and do a short segment about password security. And there's a lot to just information security in general, and even just the basics of account security. So I want to cover a few things today, and I'll likely cover some more in the next episode or next Thursday at least. Now, whether you think about it or not, you use passwords for many things on a daily basis. As technology is further woven into the various aspects of our daily lives, we continue using passwords for more and more things. The password is the most common form of authentication. So for a little bit of background, authentication refers to the process of verifying that a person is who they say they is. And there are three methods of authentication. An individual may authenticate by using something they know, such as a password, something they have, such as a token or a badge, or something they are, as in biometrics. It is most common to only have one form of authentication. However, certain systems require more than one, called multi-factor authentication. So let's get to the password security. The commonly accepted minimum number of characters for a password is 8. The usual definition of a complex password is a password with at least 8 characters, which contains at least 3 of the following: lowercase letters, uppercase letters, numbers, and special characters, such as those you get by holding down shift and pressing the numbers. It is important to use a strong, complex password wherever you have an account. Many of your accounts have your email address, your name, your address. It's important to keep track of all that information. So why do we do this? What are we protecting our passwords against? Remember that a password protects our accounts and systems from unauthorized access. It is important to protect the password so that it can do its job. A compromised account can also mean a compromised system. So if you have a user account which has some control over a system, your password keeps that system secure as well. And I'm looking at you, RF mods. There are a few common ways through which a person may obtain someone else's password and gain access to their account. First, we have the brute force attack. As its name suggests, it's a crude attack program uses every possible combination of characters to get the right password. As you can imagine, this can take some time depending on the power of the processor in the attacker's computer and the complexity of the password it's trying to guess. So this is where a complex and relatively long password comes in handy. Consider, for an 8-character password of all lowercase characters, there is obviously a certain number of possible combinations. For the first character, there are 26 possibilities. We just out the alphabet. Likewise for the second, third, and so on to the 8th. If my math skills don't completely fail me, and they might, that's a 12-digit number, and that's a pretty low number for a computer. If you only add some uppercase letters, you suddenly have an exponentially increased number of possible characters. Kaspersky's website has a tool which allows you to enter a possible password and see how long it would take an average computer to brute force it. I recommend trying this out. However, I'd advise you never to use any of your actual passwords. It's best to just test passwords that you might like to use just to get an idea of their strength. So, according to this password calculator, the generic password, pet name 01, would only take 2 hours to brute force. Change that number to 06 and it jumps to 13 hours. This takes into account commonly used character combinations. A similar form of attack is called a dictionary attack. In this case, a program uses a preloaded dictionary of common words and passwords and attempts to gain access using one of these. Again, a sufficiently complex password helps a lot. It's also very helpful not to use common words or common combinations, characters in your passwords. So here's where one more factor comes into play. In Microsoft, this is called an account lockout threshold. It means that if a person fails to log into a user account a certain number of times, the account becomes locked and no one can log into it. I'm sure you've all experienced this somewhere, and I'm happy to report that RF utilizes this because I've been locked out of my own account multiple times after trying to access it on a computer where I didn't have my password saved. So with a sufficiently complex password and a low account lockout threshold, you should be reasonably safe from these types of attacks. For your information, you can't usually change the lockout threshold because that's in the account or the website settings. But on your Windows computer, you can access the account lockout policy under account policies, and your local security policy can be easily accessed by typing secpol.msc in your run box. However, I don't recommend changing much of the stuff there if you don't know what you're doing, because you can change things you don't understand. So that's all I've got today. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff. It can get kind of boring, to be honest, and I don't want to bore anybody. Next week, though, I will talk about a couple other methods to watch out for. There are things such as social engineering, which we don't often think about, and programs called sniffers, which can look at network traffic and look at unencrypted data and just read whatever you're channeling. So for now, that's all I've got to say.
So the real question was that new segment done live or pre-recorded? And could you be able to tell the difference?
I've wondered about that.
But for real, you can leave feedback on our new section on our thread on RF. And I don't have a link to the thread, but you can just search for RF Radio, and there's like two threads about us. Well, there's like three, maybe four. Four threads, but it's one of them. I'm going to try to figure out which one.
So, what kind of news have you been interested in lately, Itty?
Well, I have recently, as of yesterday, saw something on Facebook. It was like a quick little video with a bunch of recipe ideas for ways to use squash. And some of them were particularly interesting. One was making squash fries. And I make root fries with like as many random root vegetables as possible. And by the way, the potato isn't a root vegetable, actually. It's a stem.
Hmm.
True story.
Cool, yeah.
I don't know if you know this, but the peanut actually grows underground.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I was really surprised when I found out.
I think I've known that for a little while. But, yeah, I guess, I mean, you know, it's not a tree nut. I think actually peanuts are legumes like beans. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I always think of it as a nut, but it's not actually a nut. I saw something interesting on the internet today. If you're not finished.
Yeah, no, sorry. I had a couple more squash recipes. I already make steamed squash or baked squash, but you can make like spaghetti squash and you can do it like in 20 minutes. In like a microwave, you just cut it in half, scoop out the seeds, put water down on the plate, put the spaghetti squash half down on the plate, you know, the cut side down, and then microwave it for 20 minutes. You have steamed squash, and then you can just use it as like a spaghetti. And I've done that before. It's actually pretty good. There's some good recipes out online that make a good combination for like a sauce with it or whatever. So you probably wouldn't want to eat it with like a traditional red sauce, but with like diced tomatoes and other things like that. And this one, I didn't see this in the video, but raviolis that were stuffed with some type of squash. And that's
actually, there's a lot of, but
it's a really good recipe.
I love raviolis.
And there's one I'm actually excited to try. It was for like squash burgers, or they're like meatless Mondays, and like you bake squash, peel it and pull it out, mash it, put in like breadcrumbs, shallots, and like whatever, and then form patties. And I didn't see how to cook them, but I don't know, I'm looking forward to trying that soon. So I'll let you guys know how it is. Speaking of letting you guys know how things are, I'm expecting to go see a movie tomorrow. I'm not quite sure which one, but there's two new horror movies out. And I'll probably go see one of them. And then I can probably give an interview or review it on Monday. And we're still looking for people to do segments for, like, reviews for books, movies, products, TV shows, whatever. So if you want to give a review about something, you can submit a segment to us. And you can just record it on your computer and then send me the file. And we can put it onto the show. And I don't think I told you. You guys can call in. And the number is 646-247-33. And yes, I actually know next week's test answers, by the way. Dredd does too, but we won't tell you unless you call him.
So today on Facebook, I saw something interesting. Like I probably expressed before, I'm really interested in just animals, creatures, nature, stuff like that. And this was from I Effing Love Science. And the title of the article is Deep Sea Explorers Stumble Upon a Creature That They Can Hardly Believe Is Real. I'm sure that's happened tons of times. Deep sea creatures are awesome, really weird. This one, without trying to explain it too much, it almost looks kind of like a fish. It's really long and spindly. And so it appears really weird. And from this article, this little paragraph, amazingly, although this appears to be a single jellyfish-like animal, it is in fact a roving colony made up of thousands of individual organisms called zooids or zooids, not sure, each contributing to the whole. However, more than just its older, otherworldly shape, this specimen's purple coloring is said to be rather unusual as well. So I definitely recommend looking that up, and I can share this URL in chat and perhaps in the description for today's episode as well.
Yeah, we'll probably edit a lot of links into today's episode. As we mentioned things, we tend to forget when making the episodes, things that we're going to not even forget. We don't always know what we're going to mention for what we need to link to. We're trying more and more to get more organized with each episode we do and write things out and plan things out. But still, most of what we do is kind of just us talking.
Yeah, it may not be apparent whenever you listen, but actually, like, we're usually just kind of winging it.
As he nervously laughs. All right, so we have some phone announcements. All right, next episode on Thursday, we have a couple of guests coming on and talking about meditation and mysticism. And I believe those include, let's see, Well-Named, Orbit, and Windwalker. Is that correct? Right? Okay, yeah. And then after that, on the 23rd, we're interviewing Sunstone about painting. And as you know, for the last five episodes, we've used one of his paintings as the image for the episode. So the painting you're looking at today was made by Sunstone. And on the 23rd, we'll all get to talk to him about it. And if you guys have questions you wanted to ask, you can send it to the Dreadfish or I and let us know. And we can ask the questions for you, or you can call on the show at 646-247-33 to ask any questions. We have a couple of other episodes in the works, nothing definitive yet, but an episode on feminism, on being an ex-Christian, a moderator profile. We'll not tell you which one until later. You'll have to listen in. Dredd, do you have any announcements?
Well, I don't think we have any particular announcements. but I believe now is a good time to go into our first segment of the day, minus the one I just did. It's time for our weekly segment of 5-Minute Philosophy with Well-Named. Now, you may be wondering why Well-Named is back with us, since on Monday we offer the job to Well-Named's Australian associate, Bruce. Well, unfortunately, due to an altercation with Lewis Not Miller involving the well-known No True Aussie fallacy, we all decided it was probably best to let Bruce go. So we offer our heartfelt best wishes to Bruce in his Australian drinking song sing-along cover career. In addition to that, his lawyers would also like us to offer this promotion for his West Coast Outback Steakhouse tour beginning May 5th in Washington State, sponsored by Foster's Australian for Beer. As a parting gesture, I've taken the liberty of very loosely adapting a few lines fitting for this occasion from a Australian classic originally written by the great Rolf Harris, read to compensate for authenticity in the regional accent. As an old Australian stockman lying, dying, and he gets himself up on one elbow, he turns to his mates who are all gathered round him, and he says, "It's time we let you go loose, Bruce. It's time we let you go loose. You have no further use, Bruce, so it's time we let you go loose. Time a kangaroo down, sport. Time a kangaroo down." And with that, here is 5-Minute Philosophy with Well-Named.
We shall be discussing philosophy with your host, Well-Named.
RF Radio.
Hello, Radio RF. This is Well-Named, and today I want to talk a little bit about a thought experiment in the philosophy of mind. It's called the Mary's Room Experiment, or the Knowledge Argument, and it's an argument against physicalism, which is the metaphysical position that holds that a complete description of reality would be a purely physical description, that is, that subatomic particles and masses and energies and all those sorts of physics descriptions is all that there is. So the Mary's Room argument argues against that, and here's how it was presented by a guy named Frank Jackson way back in 1982. It goes like this. Mary is a brilliant scientist who is, for whatever reason, forced to investigate the world from a black and white room via a black and white television monitor. She specializes in the neurophysiology of vision and acquires, let us suppose, all the physical information there is to obtain about what goes on when we see ripe tomatoes or the sky and use terms like red and blue and so on. She discovers, for example, just which wavelength combinations from the sky stimulate the retina and exactly how in the brain this produces the contraction of the vocal cords and the expulsion of air from the lungs that results in a person uttering the sentence, "The sky is blue." So in other words, Mary acquires all the physical information that there is to know about how functionally vision works. What will happen when Mary is released from her black and white room or is given a color television monitor? Will she learn anything new or not? It seems just obvious that she will learn something about the world and our visual experience of it. But then, if so, it is inescapable that her previous knowledge was incomplete. But, by stipulation, we've said she had all the physical information. Ergo, there has to be more than that, and reductive physicalism is false. So that's the argument. That's the Mary's Room argument. And the first thing that I want to note is that it's entirely an intuitive argument. It's not a logical argument. It's not empirical. There's basically no steps to it. The entire gist of it is when it says it just seems obvious that she will learn something. And what's interesting about that is, of course, that physicalists will rebut the argument by pointing out that our intuitions aren't necessarily very good guides to reality. They'll note that quantum mechanics, for example, is not intuitive at all, but we know that it's necessary to describe the world. And, of course, there are many other examples. For this reason, philosophers like Daniel Dennett have described this kind of thought experiment as an intuition pump, the point being that intuition is unreliable, and I think that that's a reasonable counterargument. On the other hand, there's an interesting and potentially important contrast between the unintuitiveness of the quantum concept of an electron, for example, and the experience of color, what's called qualia, the sort of phenomenal what-it-is-likeness of actually experiencing a color beyond the description of that color as a wavelength or a process of a photon interacting with an electron. The point is that concepts are mental constructions, but philosophically, our awareness of something, our immediate perceptual awareness, seems to be prior to any conceptualization. Concepts may be provisional, like scientific models may need to be falsifiable, they may need to be based on evidence, but at the same time, the entire foundation of science rests on this empirical idea that in some way our experiences are ultimate and are reliable. And so in that sense, for those to whom the intuition that qualia are real and non-reductive, for those to whom that seems true, to say that it's an illusion seems to be to question the entire basis of empiricism. It's almost a self-defeating argument to say that it's unreliable, because we're not talking about a conceptual framework, but about a direct experience. As of right now, of course, there is no scientific answer to the question raised by Mary's room argument. We don't know what consciousness is well enough to settle it that way. So, what do you think? I'm Well Named, and this has been 5 Minutes of Philosophy.
Very first thought I had after that segment was the mantis shrimp. They see a lot more colors than we do. I'm going to Google the exact amount, unless someone happens to know who's online right now. Anyone know? No? How many colors the mantis shrimp can see?
Oh, I have no idea, but I have the internet in front of me, so talk for a minute and I'll look it up.
Okay. I had some other thoughts about this segment, too, and I was kind of talking to my wife about it. And we really asked the question, it's kind of slightly oscillated, but you know the question you often hear, is my red your red? Is my green your green in experiencing the colors? And people often ask that question. And recently I've been questioning, does it even matter? As long as there's consistency to the arrangement that you see and the arrangement that I see, it doesn't matter if when I see green, you see red, as long as we both agree that that's red. Or blue, or whatever we're both agreeing it is, it doesn't matter if your experience is different than mine. As long as we're both agreeing it's the same thing, it doesn't really matter. We're still having the same experience. It's just a different point of view on the same thing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I can't find any particular thing about the number of colors. However, let's see. Mantis shrimp eyes contain 12 color receptors, and humans and most other animals use only 3 color receptors to see the spectrum of light. So do the math and you can figure they see some depth to color that we don't see.
You can't even imagine it. It's like crazy. Same thing with like extra dimensions. It was a really interesting book. By Abbott. Called I'm sorry, I'm blanking.
That's okay.
And my book, I just moved my bookshelves across like the room, so they're all misorganized. I had to take them all off because there's a lot. I tried lifting the bookshelf with the book on it, and I literally didn't move, and like my back broke, and I was like, never ever again. Oh, Flatland.
Yeah.
The book's called Flatland. And I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going to stop talking about it. And we're going to start talking about tonight's episode, and that's about Zoroastrianism. Now, we have Matt called in today to speak with us about it. So, I'll say hi. Hi, Matt.
Hey, Maz. You there?
Hi. Yeah. Hey.
Hey.
All right, so first off, what is Zoroastrianism?
Oh, well, it's a religion. It's a very old religion. And it's a monotheistic religion. It started in Iran a long, long time ago. And back then it was called Persia. Most people don't know really when exactly it started. I mean, there's some claims that say 600 BC, 1600 BC, 3000 BC. And the whole concept of the religion is that there's this good force in the universe, there's this evil force in the universe, and the good force is what we call, you know, we call God Ahura Mazda, and the evil force is what we call, you know, the devil is what we call it, Ahriman. And the two have always existed together, and they've always been fighting each other. And as human beings, we kind of have to do good to help the good force, or God, or Ahura Mazda. And we do that by following this path of righteousness called Asha. And when we follow this path of goodness, honesty, truth, we help Ahura Mazda. When we do bad things, when we have anger, when we have hate, when we lie, when we steal, whatever, we're helping Ahriman, which is the angry mind or the devil or whatever you want to call it. And the basic three sort of tenets of our religion is good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. Like, those are the three main things that we are taught since we're kids to practice. We start with good thoughts, then we continue with good words, and then we go through with good deeds. So, I mean, in a nutshell, I guess if I had to say what is Zoroastrianism, what is the main, you know, concept of Zoroastrianism, that would be that. It's good thoughts, good words, and good deeds. And it was all brought to us by our prophet called Zoroaster, and he had visions when he basically when he basically got this message. And he had the visions from God, or Ahura Mazda. So, yeah. That's basically... That's basically like the gist of the religion.
All right. So whenever I was reading up a little bit more on this before the interview, I saw the etymology, I guess, of the name Ahura Mazda. And now I can't find it for sure, but let's see. Ahura apparently means being, and Mazda means mind. So I'm just curious if there's some metaphor to this as well as the literal type thing.
Okay, so I mean, okay, like this can get really, you know, I can get really in-depth. So what happens is basically, Ahura Mazda, it means the universal mind. So Zoroastrianism is a very sort of, it's not, from a philosophical standpoint, I would say it's like a panentheistic or sort of idealistic philosophy where God is basically the mind of the universe, you know, and it's, I think, similar in concept to Brahman, which is in Hinduism also, that sort of universal sort of consciousness, except in our religion, there is, you know, there is a sense of, like, goodness to this universal consciousness, you know, which is Ahura Mazda. And Ahriman is also known as Angre Mainyu. Angre Mainyu literally means angry mind, because Zoroastrianism actually, it comes from an older Indo-European religion, which is very similar to Hinduism, where they had actually similar gods. And there was like these three like main gods. It was like Mazda, Mithra, and Indra. And, you know, after Zoroaster's visions, which he actually got from our version of an archangel, our archangel, which is Vahumana, which is the greater mind, he came with this sort of monotheistic message. But actually, it's, you know, there's like these, there was actually like a sort of pantheon of gods, just like there were in Hinduism, and there was in, you know, the Greeks and every other religion, because it all comes from the sort of Indo-European point. And through Zoroaster, it became more of a monotheistic religion. And,
That's really interesting that I had also read that it was possibly panentheistic or pantheistic, and I had never thought of that.
Yeah, it is a panentheistic religion, for example, like when Zoroaster describes heaven and hell, he talks of them more sort of mental states of being. And, I mean, there are some people who said that, you know, Zoroastrianism, I mean, okay, a lot of people say Zoroastrianism heavily influenced many religions in the world, except maybe Hinduism. And I think, like, the sort of panentheistic view influenced a lot of Buddhist thinking.
Yeah, that something you were saying was really interesting to me, speaking of the universal mind and the antithesis of Ahura Mazda being, you said, angry mind.
Yes.
So I wonder, are they really considered completely separate? You know, they're opposites and opposed, I guess, but are they really separate?
Well, we see them as separate. I mean, I don't really, like, there have been other sort of philosophical explanations that, you know, maybe they both came from the same source and all that, but, you know, I guess I never really went that far back. We see them as completely separate. I mean, maybe they came from something one. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, for all intents and purposes, within our sort of, like, own mind frame of, or the way we see the universe, we see them as two separate things, you know. And you can actually look at it even if you're an atheist. Like, I have, like, there are a few Zoroastrian atheists. I have some family members who are atheists and Zoroastrian. But even from that sort of philosophically, if you sort of, like, contribute, or if you work towards a life of doing good, you know, you can also do that as an atheist person. You can do that as a, you know, as a Christian, you can do that as a Muslim. For us, you know, it, as long as you're doing good, you're helping a good, you know, the good God, so to speak, which is Ahura Mazda.
Is there a holy book? And what role does the holy book play in the religion?
Okay. So we have this holy book. It's called the Avesta. And the Avesta, now, again, okay, so I have to make a disclaimer. I should have made this earlier. I'm not a scholar. You know, I'm not a Zoroastrian scholar. I mean, this is what I've read and what I've been taught and what I've learned throughout my years being a Zoroastrian. I mean, there are people who would be able to give you a much better, sort of more detailed answer, but I just want to let you all know that I'm not really, you know, like an expert on Zoroastrianism, but I do read. So from what I've read, the Avesta is the visions, or the sort of the prophecies that Gatha, or that Zoroaster had, which we call the Gathas, which are songs. And there are aspects in the Avesta from the pre-Zoroastrian Indo-European Iranian religion that was there. So in this book, not only are there the Gathas, which are basically the philosophical Zoroastrian teachings, which I just explained to you, but there's prayers, there's rituals, there's all sorts of stuff which have sort of an older Indo-European background to them. So the average Zoroastrian believes in the Avesta fully. So the average Zoroastrian believes in both, you know, the Gathas, which are the songs or the revelations that Zoroaster had, and the, you know, the pre-Zoroastrian stuff that's in there. But me personally, I only follow the Gathas.
How often do you turn to your holy book? How do you read from it? Do you read from it and pray every day?
Okay, so when I was a kid, I used to pray every day. I had to pray 5 times a day, actually. And before we pray, we're supposed to wash ourselves in a manner that's actually very similar to the way Muslims wash themselves before they pray. I turn to my book more for... I turn to the Gathas, which are the revelations, more for sort of like philosophical questions or any questions of good versus evil. Difficult questions. I turn to my book then, but, you know, really, you don't really need to turn to it that much. All you have to do is just know, because I think all human beings inherently know what is a good thing to do and what is a bad thing to do. And I think in the end, we, you know, have to listen to our own conscience. And I personally listen to my own sort of inner sense of goodness more than my inner sense of badness, I guess, so to speak. I do turn to my book when people ask me questions on religious forum. I turn to it whenever I'm faced with any sort of, you know, big dilemma. But otherwise, not really that much. I do have a certain prayer that I pray from our book. It's called Yathau Virio. It's like a very old prayer. It's in Avestan. It's the meaning of the prayer is more like sort of keep me on the path of righteousness, keep me on like the good path, don't let me sway from this path of righteousness. And I pray that sometimes, like, you know, as of course as all religious people pray, like before an exam or if I'm about to, I don't know, if I'm driving and like a car comes out of nowhere or something, you know, like, but yeah, aside from that, like, I don't really use our prayer book that much. Other people do. I mean, yeah, there's like a lot of prayers that we're supposed to do in a day. And some people do them. Personally, I don't do them that much, but there are some people who pray a lot because we have the five times a day prayer, and then we have these other prayers called the Kusti prayers. And, yeah. Let me know if I'm blabbering.
You're good. I have a question now.
Sure.
So you live in the West. Most Westerners aren't aware of Zoroastrianism, and I don't live near many big cities with international communities, but I've never really seen a Zoroastrian community or temple in the U.S. So why are you Zoroastrian?
I was born Zoroastrian, and I grew up in Toronto, and there's a big community here, relatively speaking, in the world, a pretty big community here. So I grew up, I went to like a lot of community functions. I have a group of Zoroastrian friends I've had since I was a kid, and it's, you know, we're still strong. It's a part of our culture as well as our religion, I guess you could say. But there are like a lot of people who, especially in more and more these days, who are like sort of mixed, like sort of half Indian or, you know, Iranian, because most Zoroastrians are Indian or Iranian. You have mixtures now coming, like white and, you know, Indian or black and Iranian or whatever. So there is a little bit of more admixture within the West in Zoroastrians. But I was born one, and I come from, my whole family's Zoroastrian, basically.
That actually answers the question I was about to answer or about to ask. But I am curious if, I guess, somebody who was not born into Zoroastrianism, if they want to become a Zoroastrian, is there some official thing involved?
Okay, so this is, again, you know, the problem with our faith is that A, it's small, and B, there's, you know, there's these two big divisions. I think, like all faiths, there's a conservative old base, and then there's the reformist young base. So, so you have basically, I would say, three population centers for Zoroastrians. Okay, you have India, you have Iran, where it started, and then you have the West, mostly Canada and America, mostly Toronto and LA, actually, to be honest with you. Toronto has mostly Indian Zoroastrians, LA has mostly Iranian Zoroastrians. So in the West, it's pretty open. I know some young priests, they're pretty cool. They're very cool. They're more liberal than I am, actually. So I think if you want to convert in the West, I think it's fine. In India and Iran, it's a much more contentious topic. And I mean, it's banned pretty much there. Iran, it's banned because, you know, it's a government, it's a theocracy, it's an Islamic theocracy. So if you convert out, you would get executed. And India, sorry.
I had a follow-up question about your prophet. And Zoroaster, and kind of what's the whole story, and how did he go to end up writing, and like what more of his history?
So he was born in being like an old religion, we don't even know really where he was born. There's two spots or three spots that people say. One was in Bactria, which is Afghanistan. One was in like the Kurdish area, like the Zargos Mountains, which is Kurdistan, and another one says he was born in like proper Iran, like Tehran or Yazd. I think Bactria, which is the Afghanistan model theory, is the most widely accepted amongst most scholars. So basically, when he was born, you know, he was said to be a very lively baby and happy baby and all that stuff. And when he was born, you know, Iran had that sort of Indo-European religion at the time. The problem is the Indo-European religion that was in Iran was very different from what was in India and in the rest of the West. It was more, there was a sort of a big emphasis on a war god. So Zoroaster, one day when he was, he was meditating and he had like these sort of revelations. He came out with these songs, and these songs are called gathas. So that's what I was saying like earlier, like I follow the gathas. These are songs that he sort of like recited. So his visions, his revelations are recited as songs. Does that answer your question? Or hello?
You there, Itzy?
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, my phone was on mute. Was it an oral tradition at first, or he writes them down himself, or how did it spread?
I don't know. I think it was oral first, and then it got written down later. That's my guess. I don't know. I'm not a scholar, but I mean, I would have to say probably oral initially. But it got written down. He lived a long life, so I think it got written down in his life. He lived till he was old. And when he he tried to like convert people, but no one listened to him. And then there was a king called King Vrishtasp who he was able to convert. And from there, it became like a sort of state religion and it kind of spread.
So I've got a question, jumping to a slightly different topic, but this is something that interests me. I know within Zoroastrianism, there is a tradition which is also shared in the Himalayas, called a sky burial.
Yeah.
And I find this very interesting. I know in the Himalayan context, it's partially practical because they don't have trees to cremate and they can't bury because there's permafrost so close to the surface, but also a compassionate aspect as well in that you're offering your body up to other beings. So I'm wondering, how does this work in Zoroastrianism? What's the purpose? That sort of thing.
So it's not really a Himalayan thing. It's actually a Central Asian thing. The sky burial has been practiced in Mongolia. It's been practiced in Tibet. It's been practiced in even Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and all these other places before, you know, Islam came. And again, it's the same concept. It's that, you know, where Zoroastrianism came from in Iran. Iran is, a lot of Iran is mountainous, desert, you know, it's not really like, not a lot of brush that you can kind of like use to cremate. So I think that's probably like one of the main reasons why the sky burial came about for us. But also for us, you know, we have this concept that you don't want to, you know, it's like you don't want to make the earth impure. And we see fire as something holy. So we don't cremate. So we do sky burials. Of course, nowadays, a lot of Zoroastrians get buried or cremated. I mean, especially in the West, you can bury in Iran as a Zoroastrian. You just have to bury yourself in like a metal casket or something. But it's the idea that you want to sort of give back to nature and you don't want to pollute nature at the same time. That's the best that I can think of it. It's like the idea that you don't want to make the elements impure with your body. Your decaying body.
Very cool.
Yeah. So,
did you have another question, Itty?
Oh, I'm sorry, my phone was on mute. You said fire was sacred. What did you mean by that? Like, why is it sacred, and in what way is it sacred?
So Ahura Mazda, again, is like the sort of universal mind, universal, you know. So we don't know how to represent him. So the best we can do is sort of, you know, come up with a sort of metaphorical, representation, a metaphorical symbol of him. And I'm saying him, it's not really him, it's an it. But, you know, I guess being part of culture and all, we attribute male qualities to God. So I guess fire would be the closest thing that we see as sort of being pure, and it's like a metaphorical representation of Ahura Mazda.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah.
I can see how that symbolism makes sense. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, people say, like, we worship fire and all that, but it's not really... People say we worship fire, but...
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, we actually wanted to take a break real quick.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so here's Louis and Matt Miller.
This is The Beatdown with Louis Knott Miller.
G'day, RF. Welcome once again to your favourite online sports segment, The Beatdown, with me, Louis Knott Miller. Can't let the chance pass to congratulate my Boston Celtics on making the playoffs in the NBA. Despite trading away their two best players and seeming determined to tank for draft picks this year, establishing himself as a seriously good pro coach, even though he looks more like a high school student, to be honest. Quick shout out too to the students at ENMU, Go Greyhounds. But without further ado, let's launch into today's interview. So our special guests here on The Beatdown today have just been made guest moderators on religious forums in a somewhat desperate bid, in my opinion, to clean up trolling that's on the boards. Whilst wrestling with theology is a common occurrence at RF, it does appear that RF management has taken the idea just a little too literally in hiring the two gentlemen I'm interviewing today as moderators. First of all, Hulk Hogan, welcome to The Beatdown. What do you say to those who say RF doesn't actually need 300-pound ex-pro wrestlers just to keep a few trolls in line?
Well, the business has changed.
And you think that that means RF needs a new moderation policy?
You know, to survive in the world, you know, you have to adapt with the environment, just like a cockroach or a crocodile that's been around for millions of years. You have to adapt the environment.
Right, sure. I can see that, I guess. A few of the moderation ideas have been sent through to The Beatdown. I just want to make sure I've understood them correctly. One of them was that no trolls would actually be banned from the site, but instead they'd be put into a cage match against other trolls. Winner gets to stay. Favourite part of that idea, I have to admit, is that it would be pay-per-view. Where exactly would the money...
Let me interrupt just for a second.
Sure, sorry. Completely forgot to introduce you to the audience, actually. Randy Savage, a.k.a. The Macho Man, welcome to The Beatdown. I've got to say, I'm kind of surprised to be talking to you.
It's been a while since I saw you.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I was talking about the fact that you sadly passed away in 2011.
Oh, yeah.
Well, anyway, do you have a message for all the trolls out there? Should they be looking over their shoulders now that you and Hulk are on the job?
No, don't look in front. Don't look to the sides. Look straight up, because I'm right on top of you. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. So how are you going to go about cleaning up the boards?
Like nobody ever does before.
And you think you're going to be able to bring the same sort of energy and effort to moderating a religious forum that you used to bring to the wrestling ring? I mean, I've got to say, I find that a bit hard to believe.
Tell Hulk Hogan that.
Well, the comment was for both of you, really, but okay, Hulk. I mean, okay, here's an example. How did it feel just to set up your username on RF?
For me, it felt weird.
And reading through some of the threads on the site? I mean, so there's some threads on panentheism, for example.
That was really weird.
And Randy, have you ever heard of Zoroastrianism? I mean, I doubt that you'd be able to give a definition of that, right?
A man in my position could never afford to look ridiculous. Do you understand that?
Jeez. Yeah, okay, sorry. I wasn't trying to make you look ridiculous. I really don't want the beatdown with Louis Knott Miller to become the beatdown of Louis Knott Miller. Sorry, Matt, my bad. But I do have some questions from some loyal listeners, and I was hoping that maybe one or both of you could respond to those. The first is from Shaz. He asks whether you've really just come to RF to try and steal all the lovely ladies from him.
Yes and no.
So you're kind of, you're trying to hook up?
Yeah, doing the thing, yeah.
Yeah, I'm there with you. I love it too.
Right, I see. Okay, maybe the next question. It's from Debater Slayer. He wants to know whether you think it's weird for an almost adult male to have a close personal relationship with Hello Kitty.
It's all kind of ways to occupy your time and entertain yourself.
Oh, yeah.
So college kids having theme parties doesn't strike you as...
I don't know what they're doing because I'm not there.
And the final question for you both is from me. You were both lurking in chat the other day when Sunstone was going on and on and on about his wish to have chrome-plated buttocks. What were your thoughts?
I mean, he said stuff like that in front of everybody, which was embarrassing, you know.
So he was out of order?
Yes and no. For me, it felt weird.
Well, that's about all we have time for now. I'm not sure that a couple of aging pro wrestlers are really going to be able to help clean up the trolls on a religious forum, but I guess we'll see soon. Randy, Hulk, thanks for the time.
Goodbye!
Whoa. Randy's clearly not so happy with being called aging, I think, but whatever. That's it for the beatdown today. On our next show, we're going to shift our focus from celebrity interviews to direct interviews with some of the regular posters you guys all know and sometimes love from our very own religious forums. First up will be FTNZ, who's well known to anyone who frequents chat. Okay, so I'll try and do better next time. But for now, Lewis Knott Miller signing off.
Thank you, Lewis Knott Miller, again for another riveting session. I am actually really excited for these troll cage matches. There is nothing more exciting than a good troll cage match. We just catch them all, kind of like Pokemon Masters, release them to a cage and make them battle, kind of like a Pokemon Master, and then we just let whichever one survives go into the forum. That's actually how I and Dreadfish ended up here. And I know that was bad English. I am just so vain, I had to say I first. It is true.
Yeah, I also really enjoyed that interview. And again, I want to say how awesome Lewis is at getting interviews. I mean, you know, he got the interview with the Prime Minister of Australia, and now he's interviewed a wrestler who's already dead. I mean, who's able to do that? Like, that's pretty amazing.
It is. Come on, well-named, you need to step it up. All you brought is a guest. You're not the Queen
Five
of England. It wasn't actually
down.
The Queen of England. I think he's lying about it. I think it really was the Queen of England.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we have been interviewing for a member Mazdean, or Maz, about Zoroastrianism. So now we will get back to that interview. Yiti, do you have any questions to start off with?
I did. I was actually wondering, if you didn't manage to hit it before, was what's your house of worship called, and what's it like, what day do you go and worship, and what's your typical experience in your house of worship? And let me actually bring you off of mute so you can answer this question. Yes, again with a mute.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're not muted anymore.
Okay. So our house of worship, in English, we call it a fire temple. In Farsi, we can call it an atashdatga. And in Hindi or Gujarati, we call it an agyari. So it's basically a fire temple. When you walk in, you're supposed to take your shoes off. You're supposed to cover your head. Men wear a cap that's kind of like a bigger cap than what most Jewish people wear. It's similar to the Muslim cap, actually. And women wear a scarf that is loose and similar, again, to what Jewish women wear when they pray or what Muslim women wear, the hijab. So you walk in, and there's a fire in the middle, or actually at the end there's like a fire, and you kind of like bow and you pray, and that's it. That's pretty much, you know, what you do. You can sometimes donate money to the fire temple. You can give like we call them sukkar, which is basically sticks. You can give them. But the thing is, like, we don't worship the fire. Like, the fire is not our god. The fire is, again, the metaphorical representation of Ahura Mazda. So that's pretty much it. And you can, you know, there's, like, seats and stuff, so you can sit there. The architecture inside is very sort of Persian, very old Persian. So you'll have, sculptures or whatever, like, that look like they came from, like, Iran, like a very ancient Iran. You'll have, like, a portrait of our prophet where he's got, like, this one finger up, which basically he's saying there's only one God. And, you'll have, like, other, like, stuff. Like, you'll have other portraits of, like, you know, priests or whatever.
Does a fire temple, does it contain like priests or anything like that?
Yeah. So we have priests. We call them dastoors.
What's their role?
So they tend to the fire. They pray. Like I said, like we had those five prayers, so they actually say the five prayers every day. Then they do other stuff, like they do the conversion ceremonies, which we call another. So there's like an initiation ceremony. It's when we turn, like before puberty, all Zoroastrians are supposed to have this initiation ceremony. It's called a Navjot. And it's sort of like they teach us the basic prayers, which are the custody prayers. But some priests, a few priests, I wouldn't say some, very few priests, they do conversion ceremonies as well, and they do a Navjot, which is part of the conversion ceremony. They tend to the fire. Now, there are some fire temples where the fire is running all the time. There are some fire temples, like the one in Toronto, it's small, and the fire is not running all the time. And you have to get, like, certain permission from, like, the fire department and stuff, like, you know. So, what else?
How often does a typical worshiper go to the temple?
Again, it depends. I mean, I go whenever I'm in Toronto, because I'm actually in the States. But I go maybe once a month, once every other month. But some people go every week. Some people never go. It really depends. Like, you know, it's variable. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to go a lot because we had a lot of community things there. Like, we had outs and stuff. So, like, but I don't go that often now.
So before I ask my next question, I wanted to mention that today's episode will run a little bit late. So if you want to keep listening, of course, go ahead. And otherwise, as always, the episode will be available to listen to at any time on demand. So
and
I want to ask...
Apparently, real quick, before you go on, the people have had a hard time finding the pause and play and... where you can skip around in the episode, and it's actually located at the top of your screen instead of the bottom or the middle. It's kind of weird, but it is at the top. So if you're looking to find where you pause it or skip around, again, it's at the top. Okay. Go. Sorry for that.
Yep. And all right, so you mentioned some people go once a week to temple. That made me wonder, is there a specific day which Zoroastrians consider the day to go to temple or some sort of weekly holy day like the Abrahamic religions have?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Okay. I mean, we have these special things called Jashans, which are basically like monthly prayers. They're variable, though. Like, they're usually it's on the weekends, Saturdays maybe, but it's because, you know, we have our own calendar. We have like an Iranian calendar. So we follow the Iranian calendar, and it has its own months, its own days, and everything. So to my knowledge, there's no special day, so to speak, but there are days where there are special prayers where you'll have people go, like a congregation. And that's
so
a prayer.
So are you saying that there's no day of worship, or no Sabbath, or are you saying there's no holidays?
There's no Sabbath. There is holidays. I mean, of course, like every religion has a holiday, but there's no Sabbath.
So what are the holidays then?
We only really... Okay, so we have like... We have the main holiday, which is Nowruz, which was basically on March 20th or 21st. It's the Iranian New Year. It is a Zoroastrian holiday. Actually, it's a pre-Zoroastrian holiday, but then it became a Zoroastrian holiday, and now it's become even, like, pretty much a cultural holiday for everyone who is from Central Asia. So people in Turkey celebrated, people in Afghanistan celebrated, people in India celebrated. That's our holiday. That's our big day. You know, it's like... Like, even the preparations, like even when Muslims celebrate it, they have, like, this, you're supposed to have this sort of table with things on it, and it's called Hafsin. Hafsin means, like, seven sort of, like, gifts or seven things. And the seven is actually a representation of the Amesha Spentas, who are the seven main angels of Ahura Mazda. So it's interesting. Like, you know, like, it's this sort of, that Zoroastrianism even now pervades the culture of
How is it to celebrate your holidays?
So you do this.
What's the typical celebration like?
So So usually you get up in the morning, you have good food. Food is a big part of every holiday. And then
in every culture, let's be honest.
Pretty much, yeah. Food is good. So you have your food, and then depending on the family, some people go to the temple. Most people go to the temple, and we have this big like sort of prayer, and we meet everyone, and I meet all my friends every year. I haven't seen, some guy lost weight, some guy gained weight. You know, it's like a good way to kind of catch up. And after that, you have a prayer, and then you have like this sort of get together. You eat, you enjoy. You're supposed to have a table called with like these seven things. Like I was saying, it's called like the Haftin. I'm not exactly sure what the seven things are. One is like a mirror, one is rose water, one is your holy book, one is grass or something. Oh man, I should know this. Anyways, so you're supposed to have these seven things. One is like sweets, and the seven things represent the seven angels of Ara Mazda. So that's what I was saying. Like, so even now today, like when a lot of Muslims celebrate Nowruz, they have these seven things.
So I was wondering, as you've explained a few different things, you seem to know some Hindi words and a couple words, or at least some words in other languages. I wonder how much of these languages do you know, and how many languages do you know?
Oh boy, I know Hindi like fluently. I can speak it, read it, write it. I can speak and read Gujarati. I know English. I know some Farsi. And that's pretty much it. I mean, I know some Spanish because I worked in the States, but it's very bad Spanish. But yeah, those are like the main four languages I know.
So I wonder, why do you know those languages? Did you just take it upon yourself to learn these? Was it because of family or something like that?
Yeah. So I'm Indian Zoroastrian. I'm culturally... So my dad's family is originally from Iran. My mom's family is from India. But my dad's side has been in India for generations now. So I was born in India, and I had to learn... And in India, the Zoroastrians speak Gujarati. So that was my first language, was actually Gujarati. And then I was in school in India, so we had to learn Hindi in school. And then Farsi, I picked up a little bit from my dad's side, and I picked up from just people, friends. I kind of took it on myself to learn some Farsi. But, the only language I really, actively had to learn was Spanish, which was tough because I had to, learn it fast. But, yeah, I mean, those, the other four, I just sort of, as part of my education, as part of growing up in the culture, because I came to Canada when I was only 11. So
you mentioned, I was actually about to ask if you had ever been to India. So how long did you live in India?
I lived in India 4 years. I lived in the Middle East for several years, too. My father worked there. A lot of South Asians work in the Middle East. And then I came to Canada when I was 11. So 4 or 5 years in India, 5 years in the Middle East, and then Middle East as in Saudi Arabia. And then I was in Canada, or I have been in Canada.
So did you enjoy it in India? Or
yeah. I mean,
go ahead. Yeah.
India is India. I mean, it's where I was born. It's my, So the Zoroastrians, when, they originated in Iran, but then they were in Iran for thousands of years until the Islamic Empire came. And after that, after it took hundreds and hundreds of years for Iran to become fully Muslim. But after that, there was a lot of persecution and stuff. So groups of people left India, and they left India for, I mean, sorry, they left Iran, and they left Iran for India. And this has been happening for centuries. I mean, Zoroastrians have been coming to India even now. People still go to India from Iran, So that's why, I know these languages, and that's why I was born in India, because we've been coming.
So Zoroastrianism is a dualistic religion. Would that be a correct statement?
It depends on how you want to, explain it. It's dualistic in the sense that there are two forces, but it's monotheistic in the sense we only worship one, we don't worship two. We don't worship the evil force.
Okay, so you wouldn't really see dualism as an aspect of your faith, then?
I mean, I see dualism in the sense, like, from a consciousness sort of, like, perspective. I'm a dualist, yeah. But
I think I lost 20 books to Orbit. She told me you say that. And do you want to expand upon that?
What? Why I'm a dualist from a consciousness perspective, or why I'm?
Yeah, I've already lost a bet, so you might as well.
Because I don't think physical mechanisms can ever explain consciousness. I don't think it's even possible. It's an internal subjective quality. It's an internal subjective experience of the universe. I mean, there's no way we can ever explain that through action potentials and neural networks. I mean, that's impossible. That's like explaining, it's like they're two completely different things almost. It's like another universe, you know? So I don't think it's ever possible. I'm not a substance dualist. I'm not a in the sense that I don't believe that, like, that the mind is fully separate from the brain. I think they both interact together. But I am a dualist, and maybe a property dualist or panpsychist or whatever you want to call it, in the sense that they are two different things. And this is like, there's no way you can, I don't believe you can ever explain the mind through physical processes. But I'm not a dualist in the religious sense, that I don't believe that there's two gods that I worship. There's only one God that I worship, and that God is Ahura Mazda. And even my aspect, the way I worship Ahura Mazda, it's not so much the way like Abrahamic faiths do. I worship him more in the sense that I try to do good and try to help him by doing good.
So I wonder, do you take inspiration from any other philosophies or religion?
Buddhism, for sure. I really like Buddhism. I like the discipline in Islam. I do. Even though I criticize the religion a lot online, I do like the discipline. It's a very disciplined religion. I believe a lot in, there should be moderation in life. You can't be totally free. You can't be totally, you know, repressed. There has to be freedom and discipline. I like Christianity. I like the cathedrals in Christianity. I've been to a few, but mostly Buddhism, I would say.
Is there any particular stance on afterlife in Zoroastrianism?
Yeah, so again, the afterlife is... So basically Zoroastrianism came up with a lot of the stuff that we see in Abrahamic faiths today. It was the first religion that came up with it, like heaven and hell, angels, sort of like freedom of choice, freedom, you know, free will. All these things are Zoroastrian concepts. And most scholars say that it was actually after King Cyrus freed the Jews from Babylon that the Jews were able to sort of incorporate some of these Zoroastrian teachings into their religion, and that's sort of why it's passed down now. There is, like, a lot of contention over whether King Cyrus was Zoroastrian. I think he was personally, but, I mean, you know, some people say he wasn't. But, you know, a lot of these ideas that we see in Christianity and Islam and Judaism actually came from Zoroastrianism. So there is a heaven and hell. There is, of course, a literal and a metaphorical explanation for heaven and hell. I take the metaphorical explanation, where heaven and hell are states of mind, states of mental being. And hell is not eternal, and heaven, I don't think, is eternal either. So what happens is when we die, the literal interpretation is, you know, we're supposed to cross this bridge. And if we've done good, the bridge is, like, wide. And if we've done evil, the bridge is narrow. And if it's narrow, we fall into hell. And if it's, you know, good, we go to heaven. But actually, you know, if you read the Gathas, which is what Zoroaster's revelations were, he says that hell is basically a mental state of, like, it's a mental state of suffering. And heaven is a mental state of joy. And once you have sort of paid your... You know, once you come to realize that what you've done is wrong in hell, you eventually come to heaven. Sorry?
Do you have a concept of, like, sin in your religion?
Anything that is wrong is sin. Anything that involves... Like, we don't have sin in the sense, like, you know... In the sense that, like, for example, in, like, how do I say... Anything which harms people is considered a sin, and anything which helps people is considered a good thing. So it's like, you know, and again, this is again the difference between the Gathas and the Avesta, which is, I personally feel the Avesta is and incorporation of the Gathas with older sort of pre-Zoroastrian ideas. For example, in the Gathas, there's nothing against homosexuality, but in the Avesta there is, you know? So I only follow the Gathas, and in that, the sins are the ones which you know internally are you're doing wrong. That's a sin.
That makes a lot of sense. But the community then would probably be split on an answer depending on which particular book they follow? Or
So the Parsis in India are... The Gathas are in the Avesta. They're not separate. But, you know, you can focus on one or the other. It's kind of like the similar concept in Islam where you have the Quran and the Hadiths. And, you know, most Muslims follow both. But in Zoroastrianism, you're seeing in the newer generations more and more Zoroastrians following the Gathas, whereas the older Zoroastrians followed the entire Avesta. You see what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
It wouldn't be...
Can you talk a little bit more about the history of your faith?
I'm sorry?
Can you go a little bit more into the history of the faith?
The history of the faith? Well, okay, so the faith started in Iran. It was the main religion of Iran for thousands of years. Up until 667, it was the major religion of Iran, 667 AD. There were three dynasties, the Achaemenids, the Parthians, and the Sasanians. And there's also Alexander's dynasty in between, the Seleucids. The Achaemenids are basically the bad guys in 300 that they show to look like monsters. They were the Achaemenids. They didn't look like that. They were actually much, much more pleasant looking in real life. They didn't really have, you know, sharp teeth and looked grotesque. As far as religious dynasties go, they were pretty tolerant. They were pretty open. There wasn't a lot of persecution of other minorities, of religious minorities. There was a lot of growth of Christianity in Armenia, for example. Armenia was part of the Persian Empire, and they were pretty... I mean, there was some persecution, but not to the same extent as other religious dynasties from other religions, I would say. Generally, overall, they were pretty tolerant. And until...
That the Magi in the Bible that came and visited Jesus were actually Zoroastrian kings?
No, they were Magi. Magi are priests.
Okay.
Magi is priest, and the modern name for Magi is Mobed.
Okay, so does it make sense that they're in there then? What's with that whole thing?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what was going on. I mean, if you want to look at it from a purely rationalistic perspective, you can say they were just luck by chance in the vicinity. I mean, Persia did rule a lot of those lands. I mean, Persia ruled most of the Middle East for thousands of years, and that's why kind of even why Iran today is still trying to play its little power games. It's been around for a long time. So, I mean, they were always there. There was traders, there was merchants, there was all kinds of people. Even in the Islamic Golden Age, there was a lot of Zoroastrians who basically contributed to the Islamic Golden Age, because the Islamic Golden Age happened in mostly Persia. It happened in Iran and Baghdad was part of the Persian Empire back then. From a rationalist perspective, you could say like they were just kind of walking, but I don't know. I mean, if you want to get more mystical, you could say they were directed there by the universal, you know, cosmic force or something. I don't know. I mean, but yeah, I mean, it's documented that they were, you know, they were three Zoroastrian priests who were visiting Jesus.
All right. Well, we wanted to thank you for having me on the show tonight. I learned a lot from tonight's episode, and I hope everyone listening did too.
Okay, sure, no problem.
Was there anything you wanted to say before the show ended?
I just wanted to finish like the history of my religion, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so we were like the majority of the Persian Empire till about the 600s. And then over centuries, slowly our populations went down. due to persecution, some genocide, and a lot of conversion. And then we went to India, the Parsis. The Parsis went about 1,000 years ago to India. And we stayed in India in Gujarat, which is a state, for hundreds of years until the British came. And then the British liked us. So we were given, you know, high positions in society. And we basically flourished in India. Some of the biggest corporations in India are Zoroastrian. Some of the bigger, like, pop culture people are Zoroastrian. Like, Freddie Mercury was Zoroastrian. His real name is Farooq Balsara, actually. And he is related to a friend of mine.
Sure.
So even today, Zoroastrianism is a big part of Iran. It's a big part of their culture. It's a big part of their identity. A lot of people in Iran who are sort of disaffected with the government, they want to know, they want to learn about their, you know, their religion, which basically gave them this sort of prestige, you know. And I believe personally that one day, I mean, I think it'll come back in Iran, not to the way it was before, but I think it'll be a much bigger presence than what it is now when the country is more free and open. And that's my bit.
It would be pretty interesting to see Zoroastrianism on a larger scale in the world.
There's a lot of interest in Iran. There's a lot of stuff going on there that is happening, but there's of course a lot of repression, so we can't really do anything, you know. So that is a more nuanced sort of political problem, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, political things will go as they go, but everything changes, so we'll see
Absolutely.
How things end up changing.
I would love to see a change in my life, but to be honest, I don't know. And I'm not that old, so.
Yeah, it is it's difficult to tell. It seemed like a lot of changes going on, and then things started to calm down again. But I think dissatisfaction in general is growing. I feel like within our lifetime we should see something.
I hope so. Let's keep on voting in smart people here who don't go and muck it all up over there.
Yeah.
But
actually,
thank you guys.
Oh, yes. I did have one more question, actually, going back a minute ago whenever we were talking about the Magi visiting Jesus. Was there any particular reason from a Zoroastrian perspective that they would have visited him?
To be honest with you, I don't know. I don't know, because he could have been like, I mean, I don't believe in Jesus in sort of a mystical way, like, you know, the way Christians see him as sort of like, you know, the Son of God and all that. But he might have been a very, like, enlightened person, an enlightened being, and maybe there was some connection to our priests. One thing I do want to add, though, is the pre-Zoroastrian god Mithra, his sort of birth story is very similar to Jesus's story, so I'm not sure what the connection is there, but Mithra became a Roman god, and Mithra became a word that's in use today in Urdu and Farsi, and it's today it's called Meher, and Meher means gift. So I don't know, to be honest, what the connection is. I don't know. I mean, I would say maybe. I'm not going to deny it. Maybe there was some mystical connection, but from a definitive point, I would say no. But I don't know. Personally, maybe.
I have a more personal question. Do you have any particularly strong personal experiences in your faith that you feel comfortable sharing with us tonight?
Well, actually, so I didn't really start practicing my faith until I was 25. Up until then, I was very unsure. I was an agnostic for a long time. I was a cultural Zoroastrian in the sense I identified with it because it was a part of my culture. But I guess I liked my faith because it was a progression of things. I lived in the Caribbean for a couple of years. I saw a lot of beauty in nature. And I guess in that beauty, I thought I saw some divinity. And there was a lot of beautiful things I saw living on an island. And from that divinity, I sort of started exploring things. I started exploring consciousness, and, you know, and then I kind of explored it for a long time, and I felt that, okay, you know, it seems to be more than what we've been told. And then from there, I combined that with my own sort of cultural upbringing, and I decided, like, you know, for me, it was the best. Zoroastrianism was the best fit, you know. If I had to even pick another religion, I would probably pick Buddhism. But, you know, in some ways, the two are very similar. I liked the whole mental aspect of everything, that it's, you know, like the universe is a mind, that our mind is the most important part of our existence, that what we are is what we think. And I think that, for me, is the most important thing.
Yeah, I really liked to learn that that was something in Zoroastrianism. And,
yeah.
That's definitely more than you would learn in any kind of world religion class. So, again, thank you very much for everything today. It has been very good, and I know that people have enjoyed it. So.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Anytime, and maybe again sometime.
Absolutely.
So,
if you want to do like a second part or something, just let me know.
All right. Most definitely. Well, that's all for tonight's episode. On Monday next week, we will be doing an episode on meditation and mysticism. We will have as our guests Orbit, Wellnamed, and Windwalker, and this will be a panel discussion in the style of our globalization episode. This is a topic that's very near and dear to me, so I'm excited about this episode, and hopefully it'll go very well. So any closing thoughts?
Don't forget, on the 23rd, we have Sunstone, and we're looking for more episodes after that. So we have a couple in the works, as we mentioned. But please contact us if you want to be involved, if you have an idea for a segment, for an episode, or just play art or music. And we're going to end tonight's episode with music by Dionysius, and this song is called Blind, Where Has It Gone?
Did I?
Sorry for the late ending tonight, guys. We'll try to avoid that. I just felt that the material is just so good, and we had a few last questions we wanted to finish with, but it was worth going over. If you did like the extended time, let us know, and if you didn't, also let us know. We try to keep the show to an hour because it seems to be the maximum amount of time that people are able to deal with the most amount of time to go over details. So did you have any closing remarks, Dredd?
I think that about covers it. It was a good show. I learned a lot of things I didn't know. And so, you know, like we said, there's a lot of material. We didn't really want to cut them off too soon because there was just so much more to cover. So if you'd rather hear us try to cut those types of episodes into two episodes, let us know. Again, your feedback is always desired. Even if it's negative feedback, it's good to know.
Constructive criticisms, my friend. It's what helps us grow.
Yep.
With that, I guess I have to say good night, good morning, good afternoon.
Good now.
Reptar.